Before we proceed this morning, in light of the fact that this is the 10th anniversary of the tragedy in New York, we'll take a moment of silence and then commence the oral argument. Thank you. We'll start with the first case this morning, which is United States versus All Funds on Deposit, etc. Mr. Hammerman?
Good morning. My name is Joel Hammerman. I represent the United States. May it please the court. Both Article III and the civil forfeiture laws require claimants to have a legal interest in the defendant property when they seek to intervene in a civil forfeiture proceeding. The proposed claimants in this case had no such interest. At the time they sought to intervene, they were, at best, prospective judgment creditors. In particular, they had not yet obtained a judgment against Al-Qaeda, let alone the specific defendant funds that were the subject of the forfeiture proceeding. They therefore had no legally cognizable interest in those funds, and they had no assurance if or when they could obtain such an interest. The claimants therefore lacked standing, both under Article III and under the requirements of the civil forfeiture laws. 10 months later, with the judgment against Al-Qaeda then in hand, the claimants, plus 11 other insurance companies that had never sought to intervene in the civil forfeiture proceeding, initiated a second action, a second proceeding, to execute the judgment that they had obtained in the Federal District Court in New York, here within the Northern District of Illinois. That action effectively sought a turnover of the same specific funds that were in the possession of the District Court for purposes of the forfeiture proceeding. That action violated the government's sovereign immunity. It ignored judicial doctrines designed to protect the respect and comity between jurists, and it undermined the exclusivity of the civil forfeiture regime. Nevertheless, the district court held that the Terrorism Risk Insurance Act served as a legal trump card that could overcome these, and frankly, any obstacles to the claimant's recovery. The court held that the execution proceeding had created a lien against the defendant funds, and that the Terrorism Risk Insurance Act obviated all the forfeiture rules that would otherwise have been applicable.
This interpretation. What was the status of the funds at that time?
They were held by the government. They were maintained in the United States Marshals Seized Asset Fund. So they were on deposit with the government, and they were, by statute, deemed to be within the custody of the government and in the United States Treasury.
Was there a hold of some kind? Anything?
No, these funds had been arrested. So they had been originally on deposit with R.J. and O'Brien and Associates, but had been arrested pursuant to warrants of arrest in rem that had been issued by the district court. So they were then in the possession of the United States government. So there was no hold on them, or they were not restrained, if that is the court's question.
All right.
There's a general fund that they're put in?
That's correct. Any seized asset that's taken by the government or put into this or a comparable fund, and they're deemed to be within the custody of the United States government. Based on the interpretation of the Terrorism Risk Insurance Act, which disregarded established principles of statutory construction, the district court determined that there was a lien on these funds, and because the claimants had a lien, all of the otherwise rules that would apply in a forfeiture proceeding were no longer applicable. And the district court ordered that these funds were to thus be turned over to the claimants, who the court determined had a priority interest in the funds. Once again, ignoring the requirements of the civil forfeiture regime, requirements like that the fact that the claimants must normally prove that they are an innocent owner of defendant funds or defendant res. The court ordered that the assets be turned over to the claimants, not only in the civil forfeiture proceeding, but the court also ordered that the same defendant property had to be turned over to the plaintiffs in the enforcement action, effectively ordering that the same property was to be turned over to two separate groups of claimants, the claimants in the civil forfeiture proceeding, as well as those same claimants plus another 11 insurers that had never sought to intervene in the forfeiture proceeding. The Supreme Court articulated what is, I think, now a well-established standard for Article III standing in Luzon versus Defenders of Wildlife, namely that to have Article III standing, a claimant or a plaintiff must have an injury in fact that is traceable to contested conduct that can be redressed by the court. The injury in fact requirement is that it must be an invasion of a legally protected interest that is both concrete and particularized and actual or imminent. These same principles apply in a civil forfeiture context, which this court has now held on a number of occasions in United States versus $574,840, United States versus $103,387, and the Tuthill Road case. A number of federal courts have held that to establish this Article III standing, a claimant must show that it has an interest in the specific defendant property at issue in the forfeiture proceeding. The First Circuit has held as much in the 1/6 share of Whitey Bulger's interest in a Massachusetts lottery ticket. The Second Circuit has held as much in United States versus Cambio Exacto.
Refresh my recollection, did he win the lottery?
He had a share in a winning ticket of the lottery, yes. He's
in no position to spend it, however.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
He's in no position to spend it, as I recall.
At the time, he was on the lam. And so the government sought to forfeit the funds, though, as funds that he had acquired as part of a money laundering scheme. But when other individuals sought to intervene in that forfeiture proceeding, including the families of two of Whitey Bulger's victims, the mothers of two women that had been killed by Whitey Bulger, they were deemed not to have standing, Article III standing, because they did not have an interest in the specific defendant property, in particular the 1/6 share in that winning Massachusetts lottery ticket. They might have had a claim against Mr. Bulger and were thus general creditors to him, but they didn't have a share in that ticket.
They had no verdict, you mean?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
They had no verdict.
They had, they'd obtained rights against Mr. Bulger. They were judgment creditors to Mr. Bulger, but they had no interest in the specific defendant property, the Massachusetts lottery ticket. The Ninth Circuit in the 133 United States Postal Money Order case, as well as the Sixth Circuit, in the Michigan Avenue, United States versus Michigan Avenue property case, all of those circuits have held that to have standing in a civil forfeiture proceeding, the claimant must have an interest in the specific defendant property. The district court in this case assumed that those courts had just been confused, got it wrong, that they had conflated concepts of Article III standing and statutory standing.
Would there be anything about these funds, this amount of money, that would be put into any kind of a special category? You know, because of the terrorism and that's the money that was recovered based on the fact that this person was part of the terror?
The fact that these funds were obtained because of their association with a terrorist organization does not change the treatment that those funds have within the context of a civil forfeiture proceeding.
Because it's... Judge Kenney said it goes into the general fund, apparently, or some fund that's not at all related to the attack and terror.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And so that way it could be used for anything.
When the funds, if they are deemed forfeited, they can be used for anything. Right. That being said, the funds that are obtained because they are forfeited, there is a means by which victims of criminal defendants can seek to make a claim to those funds, either through restoration or remission. And in although this is not part of the record, in this case, the government will take actions that will allow potential victims of, or not potential, victims of Al-Qaeda to seek to make claims under the remission process. How that process will work is yet to be determined, but there is a way in which victims, including victims of terrorism, can seek to obtain funds that are forfeited by the United States government associated with their ties to terrorism.
Well, that's a pretty limited amount, isn't it? I mean, we're not talking about any special appropriation for that. We're talking about whatever money that might be recovered?
The money at issue in this case is approximately, I think, $6.2 million.
Yeah.
And those are the funds that, if they are forfeited, which the government submits is what should have happened in this case, the victims of Al-Qaeda will be allowed to go through the remission process to make a claim. The district court, in looking at these other federal courts that had always held that these federal courts that had held that you have to have a specific interest in the defendant res to make a claim, assumed those courts got it wrong. That assumption was an error by the district court. The requirement that a claimant have an interest in the defendant funds is a requirement not only under the statutory standing requirements of the civil forfeiture laws, but is also a requirement under Article 3. The district court looked instead to this court's decision in the Tuthill Road case and assumed that this court had adopted a more lenient standard than its sister courts. Its reading, the district court's reading of Tuthill wrong, though, was also in error. Tuthill Road, like other federal courts, stands for the basic principle that to make a claim to property that is subject to forfeiture, a claimant must establish that it has a legally protected interest in that property under state law. The interest at issue is analyzed under state law, and then the import of that interest is assessed under federal law. In Tuthill Road, the claimant in that case was the rights to the property under a land trust, a written land trust, which the court held provided him certain rights under Illinois state law, and that those rights would have been injured by the forfeiture of the property then at issue. In this case, the district court read Tuthill Road to simply say that the standing requirements under Article 3 were just more lenient. The district court never explained, however, how the alleged interest of the claimants in this case, in this specific property, was viable under Illinois state law. A non-final in personam order of default, which is all the claimants had in this case at the time they sought to intervene in the government's forfeiture action, is not a legally protected interest under Illinois law. It is not an interest that, therefore, would allow them to have standing under Article 3.
No, is that a default judgment?
No, Your Honor.
Just a default?
It was an order of default. Okay. They had an order of default for, at that time, 5 years, but it had not been reduced to a judgment. And they would not obtain a judgment in that proceeding for another 8 months, and were not able to register that judgment in the Northern District of Illinois for another 2 months after that.
What was the status when the district judge permitted the amendment to the complaint?
At that point in time, they had obtained a judgment in New York. They had registered it in Illinois, and in that second proceeding in the Northern District of Illinois, they had obtained a writ of execution and served a citation to discover assets on the United States Marshals Service. That action, as I'll address in just a moment, violated the exclusive paradigm, if you will, established for forfeiture proceedings. It violated the government's sovereign immunity, and it also ran afoul of accepted principles of the abstention doctrines of in custodia legis and prior exclusive jurisdiction. But at that point in time, 10 months later, they had obtained a judgment in New York that they had registered here. In addition to not having Article 3 standing, the claimants also lacked statutory standing at the time that they filed their claims. To have statutory standing requires certain procedural necessities of a claimant that they have to follow to appear in a forfeiture proceeding, the most basic of which is that to file a claim in a forfeiture proceeding, a claimant must establish that they are an owner, that they have an interest in the defendant property. That ownership requirement is something that a claimant must meet at the time the government files its civil forfeiture action. It's uncontested that at the time that the government filed this action, the claimants had no ownership interests in the defendant funds. They were prospective general creditors at best, and the forfeiture statutes specifically state that a claimant must, in its claim, identify their ownership interest in the defendant res, and that a general creditor cannot constitute an owner. The fact that they didn't have an ownership interest under the relation back doctrine, the innocent owner doctrine, and just the ownership requirement of the civil forfeiture statutes, these claimants could not have statutory standing and did not have
it. Isn't there some logic to the fact that if the case continues to pend before the district court and the circumstances change as they did here, I mean, as far as registering it, the case could proceed under those circumstances?
No, not under Article 3 or under the civil forfeiture statute. A party must have standing at the time the case is filed. Under Article 3, under Lujan, the Supreme Court made it clear, and there have been innumerable cases that have come since that say that a party must have standing at the time they seek to invoke the court's jurisdiction, and they cannot improve that standing through subsequent action, in a sense, acquire an interest in property or acquire a case in controversy. They have to have it at the time they file. It's also well established under civil forfeiture law to have statutory standing. You must have that interest in the specific defendant property at the time you file your case. The district court found as much in this particular case, and that's consistent with cases including the Julius Baer case, the Unit H310 Opensento Garden case, the 1965 Cessna 320C twin engine case, all of these cases relying on the relation back doctrine, the innocent owner requirements of the civil forfeiture laws, and the requirement that a claimant state its claim at the time they file means that to have statutory standing, you can't improve your position as the case proceeds. You must have standing under the civil forfeiture laws when you file your initial claim.
Would you explain what a blocked asset is?
A blocked asset, Your Honor, is an asset that is blocked pursuant to, in this case, it was Executive Order 13224, which allows the Office of Foreign Asset Control of the Department of Treasury to freeze an asset that no longer allows that asset to have, in a sense, to be transacted. It can't be sold, moved, dealt with in any way, shape, or form. No, it is effectively a freeze.
No, and if it's blocked, it's blocked from use by the government, isn't it?
It is, except in this case, the government obtained a license.
Well, so this is a kind of a, we don't have that license, I don't know why, but we don't. And does that license unblock it, you claim?
It did. The government obtained that license.
Very late, though.
It obtained the license after it filed the civil forfeiture complaint.
Well, it seemed to be a sort of a reaction or maybe an anticipation, you know, kind of a peremptory thing that in order to take it away when they saw these other people with these various claims.
These assets had been on deposit at R.J. O'Brien for a period of time. There was over $26 million that were deposited in that account. They were traded, poorly traded down to $6.2 million.
Lost a lot of that, yeah.
But the government...
That was all during the block time?
No. Once these assets were blocked, they could no longer be traded. But once the department...
It would have been wise to have blocked those a lot earlier, wouldn't it?
Why was the block not earlier, Your Honor? I think the answer to that is if the Office of Foreign Asset Control had known of the association of this account with Al-Qaeda at a time prior to the issuance of the block in July of 2007, it would have blocked them earlier. When they learned of the association of these funds with a member of Al-Qaeda, Abu Al-Tayyab, they took immediate action to block these funds pending an investigation. And those assets...
Why were they put in this separate fund in the first place? They didn't know what any connection was.
They weren't put in a separate fund at that point in time.
Well, why were they forfeited then, or whatever?
They were blocked pending an investigation. And the Office of the United States Attorney continued its investigation with the FBI and filed this civil forfeiture complaint to forfeit the funds in June of 2011 when the government thought it was, at that time, appropriate to proceed with the forfeiture based on its investigation. Mm-hmm. So there was... admittedly, a prolonged period of time in which these assets remained blocked while the government continued its investigation to the time in which it sought to actually forfeit the assets. In addition to having to prove that a claimant having to prove that it's an owner, it also has to prove that it is an innocent owner. It is a requirement under the civil forfeiture statute that a claimant show that at the time that it acquired its interest in the defendant funds, that it didn't know that those funds were subject to forfeiture, and that it provides value for its interest in the defendant property. In this case, the claimants could satisfy neither of those requirements. They, of course, knew that these funds were subject to forfeiture, as they had sought an interest in them based on the government's pending forfeiture proceeding, and they didn't provide value for them. The interest that they allegedly obtained was simply seeking a lien against the funds, which under applicable law is never deemed to be providing value. So in addition to not being able to show that they were owners at the time that they filed their claim, by the time they actually sought to intervene pursuant to that amended claim, Your Honor, they were neither innocent owners as required under the civil forfeiture laws. The district court held, however, that all of the requirements of the civil forfeiture laws were obviated by the Terrorism Risk Insurance Act. And that was erroneous for multiple reasons. The first of which is, under the reasoning of the Fifth Circuit in the United States versus Holy Land case, the Terrorism Risk Insurance Act was not applicable as these assets were no longer blocked.
That's due to this license.
It's based on two things, Your Honor.
Overriding the blockage.
Yes. It's the license plus the fact that these assets were made amenable to forfeiture in the context of the forfeiture proceeding. The license allowed the United States government to arrest the funds and then to seek their forfeiture. It also allowed, by that process, any party that could establish its innocent ownership in those funds to make a claim in the forfeiture proceeding. In the context of that forfeiture, then, these assets were no longer blocked. They were no longer frozen. Any party that could meet the requirements of the civil forfeiture law could make such a claim. And under the Fifth Circuit's analysis, the TRIA was no longer applicable. The district court's application of TRIA, the Terrorism Risk Insurance Act, was also an error because the Terrorism Risk Insurance Act is not in conflict with the civil forfeiture laws. And thus, the TRIA's notwithstanding clause of Section 201 didn't and should not have acted to override the provisions of the civil forfeiture law. TRIA was designed to bypass the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act that would provide immunity for certain state sponsors of terrorism and to override Treasury blocking orders that historically had made assets that title to which remained in the hands of either a foreign sovereign or a terrorist party available to the victims of terrorism who obtained a judgment against that terrorist actor.
Well, the district court thought it was broader than that, obviously.
Yes, Your Honor, much broader.
And same with the district court in Holy Land.
That's also correct, Your Honor, but the district court's decision in Holy Land was vacated and reversed by the Fifth Circuit.
That went to the Fifth Circuit, and that was, I guess the only way I can look at this is those were so much different circumstances. It was a very narrow claim. There's a whole lot more money in that one. But this one is, I hate to use this word, a drop in the bucket, because, you know, there were billions of dollars lost in this terrorist attack. And so we're really fighting over just whatever the precedent is here.
There is precedent that's obviously at issue, Your Honor, but there's also $6.2 million that are at issue. And it's that $6.2 million that these claimants never had an interest in. They simply, at the time they filed their claims, they had no interest in that specific property.
Well, when did they have an interest, if they were?
It's the government's position that they never acquired an interest because the lien that they allegedly obtained pursuant to the enforcement action violated the government's sovereign immunity. It was violative of abstention principles, and there have been a number of courts that have held that the sole methodology of making a claim to assets that are held for forfeiture is filing a claim in a forfeiture proceeding. What happened here is these plaintiffs essentially filed a second action seeking attachment of funds held for forfeiture, demanding a turnover of those funds in a proceeding that is separate and apart from the forfeiture action. It was a workaround, if you will, to the civil forfeiture proceeding. There is no such workaround. A party that wants to make a claim to assets held for forfeiture must file a claim, must adhere to the rules and regulations of forfeiture. The district court allowed the plaintiffs in the enforcement action to simply ignore all of that, and it relied on the Terrorism Risk Insurance Act to do so. But the Terrorism Risk Insurance Act isn't in conflict with the civil forfeiture laws. It doesn't obviate all of the rules and precedent that's been established for the administration of forfeiture. the civil forfeiture laws aren't in conflict because they serve a completely different purpose than the Terrorism Risk Insurance Act, which is designed to deal with blocking orders or the immunity that a foreign sovereign might have. The civil forfeiture laws are designed to take away the ill-gotten gains of a criminal actor or to take away the instrumentalities of their crime.
In this other litigation, though, the government was represented, I assume. I mean, was the government involved in that case?
The government sought to intervene in it. Once the writ of execution had been issued and a citation had been served on the Marshal Service, the government sought to quash the citation proceeding and have the writ to quash the writ as well. And the district court, at that point, the two proceedings were joined before the same district court judge, the judge that had overseen the forfeiture proceeding, and that motion to quash was denied. And both proceedings went forward with the district court then ordering the same assets turned over to two separate parties. In the Citizens Electric case, this circuit held that a notwithstanding clause is not without limits, which is consistent with other circuit courts that have held that a notwithstanding clause is not without limits that a notwithstanding clause is not without limits in the TRIA context. Instead, a notwithstanding clause is meant to address the statute to which it is attached. In this case, the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act and Treasury blocking orders.
You're in your rebuttal time, you know.
I see that, Your Honor. I will save my rebuttal time and at that time address also.
You do whatever you want to with it. I just let you know you're doing it.
The only other point I'd like to make quickly before saving whatever time I have left for rebuttal is that this enforcement action also violated the government's sovereign immunity. TRIA speaks to allowing a party to attach seized assets, but it's assets that are seized pursuant to the International Emergency Economic Powers Act and the Trading with the Enemies Act. It has absolutely no application for funds that are seized pursuant to the civil forfeiture laws, which is what occurred here. And thus, there has been no waiver by the government of its sovereign immunity for an attachment proceeding in an enforcement action for assets that have been seized and held by the government for purpose of forfeiture. I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time.
Thank you. Mr. Carter.
Good morning, and may it please the court, Sean Carter of Cozen O'Connor on behalf of the claimant appellees. I'd like to begin just by providing a little bit of context for how this dispute arose. The claimants in this forfeiture proceeding are also plaintiffs in a much larger multi-district litigation proceeding pending in New York, involving also several thousand family members of victims of the September 11th attacks. Collectively, those plaintiffs have been engaged in efforts for many years to obtain redress against al-Qaeda and parties who provided al-Qaeda with the material support and resources necessary to carry out the September 11th attacks. As part of that effort, claims were asserted against al-Qaeda itself, and very early on in the proceeding, a default judgment as to liability was issued on behalf of these claimants against al-Qaeda. Mr. Hammerman mentioned that it was simply a certificate of default. That is not accurate, as is the case in the Seventh Circuit. Courts in the Second Circuit follow a two-step procedure in default proceedings. The issuance of a certificate of default by the clerk, which is essentially a ministerial matter, and then under 55B, the issuance of a default judgment as to liability and, in most cases, damages at the same time. The default judgment as to liability has the effect of confirming that the uncontroverted allegations of the complaint establish liability pursuant to the causes of action asserted against the defendant. Now, obviously, that was not a difficult hurdle in this proceeding as against al-Qaeda, but it did make the default judgment more tangible than a simple certificate of default from the clerk. Immediately at that time, the claimants sought to reduce their judgments to a monetary value. In entering the default judgment, the court had acknowledged the existence of damage, which was self-evident. The claimants had suffered billions of dollars in damage as a result of the attacks and had filed affidavits to support that fact. It simply held over the determination of the extent of their damages to a later date. At that point, various forces intervened to delay the proceedings, including the death, unfortunately, of the original MDL judge, and as well as proceedings as to nearly 100 motions to dismiss that were then pending in the litigation. However, very shortly before this forfeiture proceeding was initiated, all plaintiffs in the September 11 MDL approached the court and expressed a need to urgently have the default judgment on behalf of these claimants reduced to a monetary figure for the specific purpose of pursuing rights under the Terrorism Risk Insurance Act to attach blocked assets of Al-Qaeda. Very shortly thereafter, the government initiated this forfeiture proceeding, and it became publicly known for the first time that the funds at issue in this proceedings were associated with the Al-Qaeda terrorist organization.
No, what was this was what, just not published anywhere, or just
it's not
nobody, nobody knew it? Basically?
No, Your Honor, the government, and this was acknowledged in the district court proceeding, treated the existence and identity of these funds as well as their relationship to Al-Qaeda as secret non-public information continuously until these forfeiture proceedings were initiated. And simultaneously with initiating these proceedings and disclosing the fact that they were affiliated with Al-Qaeda, the government obtained a license from the Office of Foreign Assets Control and arrested the funds, bringing them into the government's possession. As soon as the claimants learned about the existence of this forfeiture proceeding and the relationship to Al-Qaeda funds, they filed verified claims. Those verified claims asserted an interest on behalf of the claimants in the defendant funds, not merely pursuant to the rubric of the forfeiture statute, but also pursuant to the provisions of the Terrorism Risk Insurance Act, and in particular, Section 201 of that statute. Now, Section 201 of that statute provides broad execution rights to parties holding judgments against terrorist parties, enabling them to execute against the blocked assets of those terrorist parties, notwithstanding any other provision of law.
Well, this is the same question I had on the other side, is this blocking and unblocking. This license came along which enabled the government to unblock. Is that correct?
Your Honor, we disagree with the government's assertion that the issuance of the license unblocked the assets for two reasons.
We don't have the license.
We have not seen the license. Its description indicates that it was issued solely to the Department of Justice and solely for the purpose of pursuing the forfeiture of the defendant funds. So in other words, prior to the arrest of those funds, they would not have been available to Abu al-Tayyeb, the al-Qaeda member who technically owned them. The only party who could access those funds was the Department of Justice, and only for the purpose of invoking its rights to try to forfeit them under the civil forfeiture statute. And because of that, the interplay between the civil forfeiture statute and the Terrorism Risk Insurance Act is critical to virtually all aspects of the district court's decision. Now, the government, in its argument and in its brief, asserts that the notwithstanding any other provision of law language of TRIA should not be deemed to reach unrelated legal regimes, but should instead be deemed to only set aside statutes dealing with the same subject matter. It then argues that the civil forfeiture regime does not deal with the same subject matter as the Terrorism Risk Insurance Act, and therefore the language should not reach the civil forfeiture statute. The problem is that the civil forfeiture statute does in fact deal with the same subject matter. In October of 2001, the civil forfeiture statute was amended through the Patriot Act to include provisions that specifically authorize the government to pursue forfeiture of assets associated with terrorists or assets associated with acts of terrorism. And as a consequence of those amendments, the civil forfeiture statute from that time forward has dealt very specifically with the subject matter of terrorist assets, and it has prescribed a set of rules concerning their treatment and disposition. Now, very shortly after Congress passed those amendments to the civil forfeiture statute, a year later, it passed the Terrorism Risk Insurance Act, which included Section 201. Section 201, by its very plain language, also deals clearly with the subject matter of terrorist assets and sets its own rules for the treatment and disposition of those assets. And so even by the government's narrow interpretation of the reach of TRIA's notwithstanding any other provision of law language, the district court was correct in concluding that it reached the civil forfeiture provisions at issue here. The government was proceeding under the specific civil forfeiture provisions dealing with and authorizing the forfeiture of terrorist assets.
Now, this all occurred subsequent to the unblocking, didn't it?
No, all of the amendments to civil forfeiture occurred back in 2001. The blocking of these particular assets occurred sometime around 2007, and they remain.
That's right. So there was this. That's where the stretch in time was for whatever reason.
Right. They remained, Your Honor, in a block status in the accounts where they had initially been deposited from 2007 until they were arrested in 2011.
Well, this license and unblocking came along at some kind of a crucial time, or just before, right?
The license
about the whole process here, but that's I'm trying to figure out.
Yes, Your Honor, the license issued immediately after the or immediately before the filing of the civil forfeiture action, and it was pursuant to the license that the government then, at the same time the forfeiture proceeding was filed, arrested the funds, and all of that happened in that period of September. Of 2011, or I'm sorry, July of 2011. With regard to the district court's conclusion that there was a conflict between these two statutes and that TRIA superseded it because they dealt with related subject matter, some of the examples that Mr. Hammerman offered today only reinforce that view. He cited, for instance, the provisions of the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, as well as regulations issued by the Treasury Department under Executive Order 13224. The Treasury Department regulations referenced were enacted for the purpose of sanctioning parties who provide financial resources to terrorists and ensuring that terrorist supporters and the organizations they benefit do not have access to the funds necessary to carry out acts of terrorism. Those regulations were not instituted for the specific purpose of blocking execution efforts by terrorist judgment holders at all. However, because they dealt quite comprehensively with the subject matter of terrorist assets, they did by operation serve to present an obstacle to those efforts. Similarly, the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act does not deal specifically with blocked terrorist assets. It sets up a regime of rules under which assets of foreign sovereigns are immune from attachment. By its operation, it historically had the effect of preventing parties holding judgments against terrorist sponsor states from attaching their assets in satisfaction of their judgments, for instance, their diplomatic property. And so for all of those reasons, the civil forfeiture statute, as invoked here, quite clearly dealt with the same subject matter and was in conflict with the provisions of TRIA concerning the treatment and disposition of terrorist assets. Now, as the district court...
If I could take you back, you took us up to the point where they were determining the amount of liability or the damages, but we didn't get beyond the fact that they filed affidavits. Was there a damages hearing, or what was...
Your Honor, there were affidavits filed in 2007 in support of the effort to monetize. The motion sat unaddressed for quite a number of years. It was raised a few times to the district judge who was presiding over the MDL as being ripe for resolution in letters submitted by both the plaintiffs and the defendants in the case. In that early summer period of 2011.
The defendants also filed counter affidavits?
No, the defendants, these were defaults. The default judgment did not run to the defendants who had appeared, merely as a case management matter.
So the parties to which normally in these things you have a damages hearing.
Correct.
Typically. This was not, why didn't that type of thing happen here?
Because the defaults were being sought solely against Al-Qaeda and without having any legal impact on other defendants. And so the sole issue left undone was for the court to look at the affidavits and determine the amount of damage. It wasn't a contested proceeding as a consequence of that. And so when the group at large, both the claimants here and the individual plaintiffs, wrote collectively to urge the court to turn on that issue, it did in fact then somewhat promptly refer it to the magistrate judge, after which a monetary default judgment issued, as Mr. Hammerman said, while these claims were still proceeding.
But that involved, the magistrate judge concluded, you know, numbers in billions. One was $6 billion, another is $1 billion plus.
The value of the judgment was in excess of $9 billion, Your Honor. That in part is because the claims arose under the Anti-Terrorism Act, which has a mandatory treble damage figure. So the compensatory award was somewhere in the range of $3 billion, and it was relative to the compensatory amount that the claimants sought to attach the Al-Qaeda funds as provided under the Terrorism Risk Insurance Act.
Well, I'm just saying that when you have the hearing and final damages, they're so much bigger than whatever money's available. I'm not sure how. I think those folks would have to sort out what fraction they're going to get sometime later, wouldn't they?
Well, Your Honor,
insurance companies, for example.
Well, the insurance companies are all working collectively and represented by the same counsel, my firm. There was an agreement reached among all of the plaintiffs in the multi-district litigation proceeding to apply any blocked Al-Qaeda funds for their common benefit and to their common interests. And as a consequence, this really proceeded as an effort on behalf of the entire plaintiffs group in the 9/11 multi-district litigation proceeding. With regard to the district court's finding about the reach of TRIA, the conclusion was bolstered not only by the fact that these two statutes dealt with the same subject matter and were in conflict, but also by its recognition that Congress had enacted Section 201 of TRIA to provide a comprehensive vehicle for victims of terrorism to execute on their judgments and to end executive branch interference with those efforts. And so it obviously would make very little sense to leave in place and unaddressed by that statute a civil forfeiture regime that dealt with the same subject matter, that is, the assets of terrorist parties, and was uniquely suited to use by the executive branch to prevent execution efforts by terrorist victims. And the outcome that the government advocates here very much bears that out. The government's view of the law is that it can treat the existence and location of these funds as secret, non-public information up to the point that it decides to move for their forfeiture. It can then initiate the forfeiture proceeding and, attendant to that, obtain a license to deal in the funds and arrest them. At that point, the government would argue that the claimants who never could have had the capacity to place a lien against any of the funds because they could not possibly know where they were, are too late to possibly have standing, and in addition, have no vehicle to even attach a lien at that point because the funds because they're within the sovereign immunity of the United States. And so the district court correctly concluded that that was the kind of use of a related statutory scheme TRIA was intended to set aside. And that conclusion also informs the district court's holdings with regard to the import of the license that was issued to the United States. Again, the license was what they call a specific license. The Office of Foreign Assets Control issues two type of license: a specific license, which issues only for the benefit of the individual applicant and for the specific purpose described in the application, and a general license, which serves to allow any party to deal in the identified transaction, funds, or activity without seeking any further approval from the Office of Foreign Assets Control. The specific license issued here to the government, again, extended only to the Department of Justice and solely for the specific purpose of pursuing forfeiture of the funds. And because of that, it did not serve to generally unblock these funds. The blocking order as to the funds remained in effect as to every party other than the Department of Justice and for every purpose other than the forfeiture of the funds. There's an additional problem with the government's license argument. The license was issued purely incidental to and for the effect of allowing the government to invoke its rights under the civil forfeiture statute relating to terrorist assets. And so it makes little sense to conclude that a license issued solely for purposes of giving effect to statutory provisions that have been set aside by the Terrorism Risk Insurance Act actually serves to give primacy to the very statutory regime TRIA sought to set aside. And that is also a problem that runs to the government's sovereign immunity argument. Now, again, the funds were arrested pursuant to the license at the very outset of the forfeiture proceeding. The government argues that once they were seized by the United States, they were beyond any ability of the claimants to obtain a lien. But TRIA specifically indicates that it allows judgment holders to execute against funds that are frozen by or seized by the United States, seized by being a relatively clear term indicating funds that are in the possession of the United States. And in fact, Mr. Hammerman acknowledged that these assets were placed in a general seized asset deposit fund. And so to the extent that TRIA very explicitly says that it provides a vehicle for terrorism judgment holders to execute against assets seized by the United States, it must necessarily provide a waiver of sovereign immunity for them to take the steps necessary to execute against such funds.
Well, is that... Was that another option available to you to do, in, apart from this lawsuit, to then, apart from that, to go to the government and say, we want to recover whatever the amounts are for your clients?
Your Honor, if you're referring to the remission process that Mr. Hammerman described, the government, throughout the at least underlying proceedings, would was unwilling to commit that the remission process, which is entirely discretionary, would actually be employed in this case. The other problem with the remission process is that there are more than 9,000 individual victims and family members who are plaintiffs in the case, as well as all of the insurance companies. For the remission process to operate, it would require some sort of administrative process whereby those individuals would demonstrate their standing to make a claim against the funds, a process that would necessarily involve them revisiting the horror that was inflicted upon them on that day solely for purposes of taking their de minimis share of $6 million. And for that reason, they determined that a far preferable option would be to reach agreement with the commercial parties who could very easily prove the value of their damages and use those claims and those judgments as a vehicle to attach these funds for the common benefit of all involved. And that was the process that was undertaken as soon as we learned of the existence of these funds. Turning briefly to the standing issues that were raised by Mr. Hammerman, there are essentially two problems with the standing position advocated by the government. The first is a simple resistance to the controlling decisions of this circuit as to standing generally and also within the civil forfeiture arena. Mr. Hammerman cited quite a number of cases from outside of this circuit standing for the proposition that general unsecured creditors do not have constitutional standing to appear and participate in a civil forfeiture proceeding, but this court's decision in Tuthill Road clearly took a different view of that issue and actually indicated the courts who had taken that position were conflating merits determinations under the civil forfeiture statute with questions of constitutional standing. Constitutional standing merely requires that the plaintiff, or in this case the claimant, assuming a claimant needs to demonstrate constitutional standing to participate in a forfeiture proceeding, demonstrate an imminent threat of injury fairly traceable to the defendant's conduct that a favorable judicial decision would redress. And so this court in Tuthill and elsewhere has described that as a very undemanding standard. It has elsewhere described the kinds of injuries which would qualify or the threat of injury that would qualify as not requiring any certainty or even a high probability of harm, but just some non-negligible, non-theoretical probability of harm that the suit would redress. And in addition, a claimant is not, at the outset of a proceeding in particular, required to demonstrate that a right has actually been infringed. Rather, the question is whether or not the claimant has a colorable claim to such a right. And the standards that Mr. Hammerman articulated for standing simply run afoul of the interpretation of those rules by this circuit. The additional problem is that the government, in discussing the question of standing, focuses solely on rights asserted by the claimants in this proceeding under the civil forfeiture statute. But the claims asserted in this proceeding asserted rights under the Terrorism Risk Insurance Act, and specifically they asserted that the claimants had rights under Section 201 of the Terrorism Risk Insurance Act to attach blocked assets of terrorist parties, including the defendant funds at issue in this proceeding, and that those rights were superior to any forfeiture rights the government might otherwise have. The claims thus presented in a very clear adversarial context the competing interests of the claimants and the government. There was nothing intangible about the claim to a right made by the claimants. Again, a default judgment as to liability had been issued. The only question that remained was the value of that. It was an uncontested proceeding. There were affidavit testimony. There was an absolute certainty acknowledged by the district court that damage had occurred. So the only question really was the timing of the issuance of a formal monetary award. Meanwhile, the harm that these claimants faced was unquestionably imminent by virtue of the government's action. If the government had succeeded in forfeiting the funds, the claimants would have immediately lost the right to attempt to attach those funds. And this is very closely analogous, as the district court observed, to the circumstance presented in Tuthill Road. The claimant in that case, as this court observed, could not be described as even a beneficial owner of the property at issue. As Mr. Hammerman indicated, he had certain rights arising under a land trust. Specifically, he merely had the right to enjoy some participation in the proceeds in the event that the property was sold at a later date. However, the land trust also provided the trustee with the absolute authorization to donate the property, to sell it for no value, and to transfer it. And as a consequence, that claimant's rights and interest to that property were completely contingent on a potential sale that was entirely unknowable at some date in the future, which was itself contingent on the trustee not taking adverse action, and obviously also subject to the vagaries of the real estate market and mortgages as to whether or not there would even be a profit from the sale. The claimed interest here is far more concrete than that. The claimed interest here arose from a default judgment relative to which the entry of a monetary award was imminent. That certainly provided a colorable claim for purposes of pleading Article III standing. As the case proceeded and before summary judgment, the claimants obtained an actual lien against the funds. And so at that point, there was no question that they had satisfied any applicable standing requirement. Turning just very briefly to the government's arguments concerning the common law doctrines of prior exclusive jurisdiction and in custodia legis, the government argues that those prevented the service of the writ of execution or invalidated it. The district court was correct for very practical reasons in determining that those common law doctrines were not implicated at all in this case. First, the district court observed that both the writ and the citation did in fact issue from the same court, the Northern District of Illinois, albeit Judge Gettleman rather than Judge Kennelly. Perhaps more importantly, Judge Kennelly assumed handling of both the execution proceeding and the forfeiture proceeding at a very early stage while the government's motion to quash was still pending. Judge Kennelly is the one who denied the motion to quash pursuant to the common law doctrines. He indicated on a number of occasions that he would have acted the same as Judge Gettleman had, and that even had he deemed the common law doctrines applicable, he simply would have issued new writ of execution and citation to discover assets at that moment.
Well, this, in this case, is it confined to the 6 point whatever it is million?
It's confined to 6.7 million or so.
But the reason I say that is maybe there will be other, even possibly Al-Qaeda funds recovered sometime or other. Will it ever extend to those, or is it confined to this incident?
Your Honor, I think that the facts of this are particular in that there was a lien placed against these particular funds, and so in the event that there were a subsequent forfeiture action involving Al-Qaeda funds and a group of judgment holders sought to assert a lien against them, it seems to me that they would likely have the right to do so, but the particular circumstances of it would dictate. There's one also issue with regard to the government's reliance on Holy Land Foundation that is of note. Holy Land involved a proceeding under the criminal forfeiture statute, which, as it happens, does not include provisions specifically dealing in terrorist funds. And so whether or not the same kind of tension exists between statutes dealing with the same subject matter is unclear. In addition, in Holy Land, there's no indication that the claimants in that proceeding suggested any difference between a specific license and a general license. So one of the arguments offered here simply does not appear to have been presented or considered in that litigation. If the court doesn't have any more questions, I'll conclude.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
How much time? You have 3 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Claimants' counsel argues that because both TREA and the forfeiture statutes address generally subject matters of terrorism, the two statutes must therefore be in conflict if one would preclude recovery under the other. That is a position that was explicitly rejected by the Fifth Circuit in the Holy Land case. It's implicitly rejected by the Second Circuit in the Smith versus Federal Reserve case, where once again two statutes both dealt with terrorism, but the Second Circuit refused to read the notwithstanding clause to obviate or to supersede any potential statute that would have the effect of precluding recovery. And frankly, it's implicitly the same argument that was implicitly rejected by the Supreme Court in the Elahi case, the same statute that addressed issues of terrorism. The purpose of the statutes is what is to be analyzed to determine what a notwithstanding clause will supersede, not its effect in a particular case. Under the theory that's advocated by the claimants counsel here, any statute that would preclude these particular claimants from recovery would be superseded by TREA, and that is simply a position that has been rejected by the Supreme Court and every circuit that's looked at it. TREA is also not a waiver of sovereign immunity in this case. While it does reference assets that are seized by the United States government, it says more than just seized. It says seized pursuant to two specific statutory regimes, IEEPA and TWIA, the International Emergency Economic Powers Act and the Terrorism Trading with the Enemies Act. These assets were seized under a totally different statutory regime. They were taken for purposes of civil forfeiture. Thus, TREA does not mention that, and as the Supreme Court has said on a number of occasions, including Blue Fox, Lane versus Pena, a waiver of sovereign immunity must be explicit, and it cannot be read implicitly, which is what, in fact, the claimants are asking the court to do here. With discussing the concept of remission, claimants' counsel suggests that it's appropriate that the court take action in this case because there's so many potential victims. Well, that's often the case in the civil forfeiture context. And civil forfeiture has set up a regime whereby the executive branch determines what assets may or may not be paid out to potential victims of a criminal wrongdoer. If it were otherwise, if the court were to endorse the position advocated by claimants' counsel, district courts would effectively be turned into bankruptcy courts, trying to determine in every case in which there's a Ponzi scheme or multiple victims of some form of criminal activity, which claimants get what amounts of what is often a limited amount of funds, like there is in this case. Claimants' counsel also says that Section 201 of the Terrorism Risk Insurance Act creates an interest in property. It does no such thing. It simply supersedes blocking orders and other things that immunize assets from attachment. That's not what occurred here. Finally, the concept of imminence doesn't exist in this case. When these claimants would get a judgment was unknown at the time they filed. Whether the assets would still be there, if other claimants would beat them to it, was unknown. There was simply speculation of when they would be able to obtain a lien and against these specific funds. That was unknown, and there was just expectation toppled on top of expectation, which the Supreme Court in Clapper said is simply not a way in which to that is simply too speculative to meet the actual and concrete injury or imminence requirements of the injury in fact requirement. For all those reasons, we would ask that the court vacate the district court's decision below. It is a decision that ran afoul of a number of different things, and we'd ask the court to vacate the district court's judgment and remand it with an instruction that the district court enter judgment in favor of the United States.
Thank you, Mr. Hammond. Thanks to both counsel.